Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Mark and Sarah,
call it a comeback.
Mark and Sarah,
been here for years.
Mark and Sarah talk about songs. Talk about songs.
We have been here for years, and if there's anything I've learned in that time, it's that ladies love cool Andrew Byrne, who wrote part of that theme song, and James, who wrote the other part, and it's me, Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your co-host, and I'm here, as always, with Mark Blankenship. Mark, how are you?
I've been here for years. You want to tell me you kids don't know a thing?
It's true. You don't, but you're about to learn all about comeback songs because it's an all-new season of Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, and we are talking about comebacks, as you've probably gleaned. Mark, this brainchild is yours this time around. So talk a little bit about how we got here and where we're going this season.
Well, I'd love to. If you've listened to this podcast for more than 2 seconds, you may have noted that I have an interest in the Billboard charts.
What?
I know.
Now you tell me. God.
And earlier this year, I was paying attention to them, as always, and I was thinking about how one of the songs that we will discuss in a later episode had come out of nowhere and suddenly put an artist that I assumed had forever been dustbinned back into the upper reaches of the chart. And I found myself rooting for this song and this artist, even though I have no real use for their music.
Which, may I ask which artist it was? Because I don't remember.
Oh, yeah, okay. Whatever, I'll just spoil it. It's the Meghan Trainor song that we're going to be talking about in episode 3.
Right. I had forgotten the origin song. I thought maybe it was the Neil Sedaka song that we are somehow talking about later, but we will get there eventually with God's help.
Yes. So I was thinking about the fact that, you know, I could take or leave Meghan Trainor, mostly leave, honestly, but I was still rooting for her return to chart prominence, and it got me thinking about comebacks and that old saying that everybody loves a comeback and that the pop charts are frequently, to my mind, more interesting when they contain a comeback because you truly can never predict what's going to be a hit, what's going to work. As much as we all think that we can, it's not really true to always know what's going to succeed. And that got me thinking about how much fun it would be to use our current season structure to figure out the all-time greatest comeback song through our time-tested, patented methods. Please don't look to the government to confirm the patent. We no longer believe in them as an authority. And so here we are. And one of the things that I'm interested to talk to you about, Sarah, as this season progresses, is what makes a comeback a comeback? Because I thought that I had an easy answer for that question when I started thinking about this. But the more I try to explain it even to myself, the more I realize that it's a murkier proposition than I had given myself time to realize. So as we so often do now, wrapping my arms around, or wrapping our arms around, the general concept or theme of our season is going to be fun, and I don't know where it's going to take us.
Yeah, I really don't either. And Patreon supporters of our page at patreon.com/masteds have already been voting on this stuff. So I'm going to talk in a second about our process for that. But I will say that a lot of the comments, as they often do in situations like this, like we have an idea for the season, but then we're really forced to confront a lot of philosophical questions on the way to crowning a victor. I mean, you know, the winner in these seasons is always us, because it's super fun to talk about and contemplate mm-hmm. these things. But like, what does it mean for something to be more of a comeback than another song? Like, is it the
right,
how big the song was? Is it how far the artist had fallen previously? Is it how different it is? Is it that we just forgot about these people? Like, is a comeback for Madonna different from a comeback for Neil Sedaka right. or for Cher, who both was always making a comeback but also never went away? Like, there are a lot of questions. And we have a quantitative system of answering those questions. Shall I break down the scoring for these early rounds before we get into it? Or do you have any other chart concepts that you need to share with us?
All I will say is that there are so many chart facts coming in this season that we've created a special sound drop mm-hmm. to identify them, because this is really just a chart nerd's dream, this yeah. opportunity. Other than that, I would say jump right in and explain how we're totting up the points.
All right. Well, here is the scoring. We have 60 songs on our initial list. Often we do 64, so it's closer to like bracket numbers, but we kind of just wanted something that was divisible by four and not an unwieldy number of songs. So we went with 60. Each of the four opening rounds will contain 15 songs. We each get a vote. Our Patreon supporters get a vote. And in these early rounds, we're not ranking them so that like the top song gets 15 points, the second one gets 14, and so on. In these early rounds, it's just an up-down vote. So if you voted for a song to go through to the next round, it gets 2 points. And if you didn't, mm-hmm. it gets none. So that's how we do it in the early round, just to keep it a little simpler. I, of course, go ahead and rank them all like I usually do, because I love pain. But, and also it's helpful, like if there's a tie and we don't want to send 9 songs through to the next round, then we can make some decisions after the math has been done. But that's basically how it works. We're starting with 60 songs, and in this round, we have 15 songs. The top 8 will go through. Did I miss anything on the administrative side before we start talking?
No, you did not. I think that we're all good. Shall I reveal today's selection?
Please.
So today's 15 tracks are American Idiot by Green Day, Bad Blood by Neil Sedaka, Believe by Cher, Can't Get You Out of My Head by Kylie Minogue, Cold Heart by Elton John and Dua Lipa, Come Dancing by The Kinks, The Crying Game by Boy George, Dancing on My Own by Robin, The Doctor by the Doobie Brothers, Don't Know Much by Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville, The Flame by Cheap Trick, Flowers by Miley Cyrus, Freeway of Love by Aretha Franklin, Frozen by Madonna, and Get Lucky by Daft Punk, Nile Rodgers, and Pharrell Williams. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, a couple of these. I love that like past seasons always come back to
haunt yes.
/ delight us. Hello again, Pharrell. All right. Well, my problems began immediately with this round. Like, sometimes you look at a list and you're like, oh, this will be cinchy. I did not think it was going to be cinchy, and I was right. It was a battle to pick the 8 that we're going to go through, but let's get started.
Okay, so we begin with a song that honestly challenges my early assumption about what even constitutes a comeback song. That is American Idiot by Green Day. But I do think it's worth discussing because even though Green Day never really went away, they had receded from mainstream view by the end of the 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they had Good Riddance, Time of Your Life, but then they had some albums in there that nobody was really listening to outside of their core fan base in alternative rock. Even though the song Minority, for instance, is great, it didn't really break through in a huge way. And then the American Idiot album, as introduced by the American Idiot single, really, I think, changed forever the way that we perceive the band Green Day. Suddenly they were super sophisticated. Suddenly they're like, oh my God, they're so gifted and brilliant and sophisticated. And so that to me, Sarah, is why it's worth talking about, because a comeback could be a shift in the public perception of a band. And mm-hmm. if that is true, then this is a great example of that.
Yeah, I love that this was the first thing that we were talking about in the context of this season, because I remember putting this album on primarily because our esteemed colleague Omar Gayaga had been raving about this album, and I put it on. I had listened to Green Day in college, so like the early to mid 90s iteration of them, and it was like, it was like Welcome to Paradise era. It was, you know, like not fine, but like it was fine. Like I didn't necessarily seek it out, but it was in my environment all the time and I was fine with that. Right. I put this on and it's like, this is the opening track of that album, I believe. And
yes,
it's not the best track on that album, but it still seemed from the opening, like four bars, I sort of sat up and was like, huh, because it still is recognizably Green Day, and you can't exactly call it a quantum leap forward because it hasn't evolved so far past what they had been 5 to 7 years before that it's like unrecognizable or anything. But I absolutely remember being like, oh, this is the apotheosis of what this band can do. Like that right. they have become like the ne plus ultra of themselves, that they understand how to harness the specific punk energy rage, and like they knew which corners to sand off and which points to make sharper. And yes. American Idiot was that. Like, again, I don't think it was like a great leap forward exactly. It was just like, I don't exactly know how to put it, but it seems like you understand what I'm saying, that it was like, this band is now operating at the top of its powers, which are much more formidable than we thought. And
I completely agree.
Yeah.
For me, before this, Green Day was a great producer of individual tracks that mm-hmm. would be fun distractions.
Mm-hmm.
With this album, suddenly they made a roughly 60-minute musical statement, and I wanted to hear the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that was brand new to me. The idea that Green Day was adroit enough to say something at length in a single album. And it really was like an album I always wanted to hear from the beginning to the end. And that sense of scope and that sense of craft and that sense of intention was so exciting to me. I mean, it's still exciting to me. This is still a great album. I still have, within the last year, I have listened to the whole thing all the way through at least once. And
yeah. It's sort of shocking that it's over 20 years old. It still feels very fresh. And there is that
yes.
maturity to it that this band sort of realized, okay, we're going to have to slick up our sound a little bit to get the sophisticated things done that we want to get done narratively. And
yes.
it was exciting is the perfect word. Because it was so exciting to like hear this happening in your ears and be like, huh, wow.
Right. Yeah. And thinking about the messaging, for instance, because what you said is true. It's not like this is some huge leap forward or some huge shift in terms of their purpose as a band. But I think about the song Minority, which I mentioned earlier, which contains the chorus lyric, down with the moral majority, I want to be the minority. Okay, mm-hmm. like that's a good line. I enjoy shouting that. I always imagine myself singing it at a school assembly in high school. and then making the principal mad. It's just kind of that type of lyric. But then American Idiot, the song, features the lyric, "Maybe I am the faggot America."
Mm-hmm.
And that is an even sharper version of the same sentiment. It's ruder, it's harsher, it's more striking, and it's exactly what you said. It's just taking what was working and making it even better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really love that. Now, is it a comeback? Yeah, actually, I think it is. Is it, to me, one of the 8 biggest comebacks on this list? And biggest, best? I was kind of using my gut to just decide on this in this early round. And for me, no, it is not. It would probably be like 10th out of 15 as a prime example of a comeback. But I still really like the song, and I'm still really glad that it's in this conversation.
I was very glad that I was able to tease out for myself what it was about this that made it, that set it so apart from previous work by the same group. I do think it's a comeback, but it was close to the line for me. But I did vote yes on it, so it gets 2 points from me.
Well, the patrons agreed with you, so they also put it through in their top 8. So now we have 4 out of a possible 6 points for Green Day's American Idiot. Just a reminder for those listening, if you would like to be voting in future rounds of this podcast, just go to patreon.com/mastis, and you too can vote in these elections that are so important and honestly will do more for you than any other election ever will.
It's true. Way less stressful with the outcome, too.
Yeah, for real. Okay, so, Sarah, I wonder for our next song, Bad Blood by Neil Sedaka, did you have an existing relationship with this song? Do you remember it at all?
Existing relationship with this song? I didn't. And, well, let's play a clip because it's been 15 minutes of us chatting. We haven't heard any music yet. So let's do that and then let's get into it.
I love it.
Okay, Neil and friends. I mean, I had no pre-existing relationship with this song. I'm sure I had heard it before because it does have a familiar sound, possibly because the same dude who wrote it also wrote Captain and Tennille's Love Will Keep Us Together. Like, there is a certain, you know, kind of flair that has. And then
right.
That you're like, wow, that background guy sounds like Elton John. Tis. David Foster's on the keyboards. Like, this is assembled from parts that you know.
Yes.
And I don't, like, I don't think it's great. And I don't need to hear it again. But my experience of playing this on YouTube and being like, what? Coming from Neil Sedaka TM is like, okay, wow, all right, so I guess we're really doing this funky mid-70s thing. And I think it had been long enough since he had a hit that, and this is different enough from previous stuff. I had no idea what to expect from this, but I do think it's a comeback, and I did give it 2 points.
Listen, what's your feeling? I think that this song represents, to me, it represents the epitome of what comebacks are, because Neil Sedaka, when in the mid-70s, had not had a hit since the Beatles arrived in America. Mm. So it had been like over 13 years since he had been able to chart in the top 20, let alone the top 10. He'd had a number one single in the early 60s called Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, but then it had been kind of lost in the wilderness era for him. Mm-hmm. And then he got signed by Elton John to Elton John's boutique label Rocket. And he had a number one song called Laughter in the Rain, which technically was number one before Bad Blood. And I guess if you really want to get down to brass tacks, is maybe the song we should have been talking about, but because Laughter in the Rain is, first of all, a song I do not like, it also sounds like every other glurgy Neil Sedaka song that you can imagine. Right. I thought this was actually the more interesting story because it was his second consecutive number one hit after having had no hits. And like you said, it just sounds like an Elton John song. Elton John's vocals are incredibly prominent. In fact, if this song were released today, it would absolutely be Neil Sedaka featuring Elton John.
Yes.
No question.
Absolutely.
And Neil Sedaka had at this point also, as you mentioned, just had a huge hit as the writer of Love Will Keep Us Together. So 1975 was a big year for Neil Sedaka. And then he managed to cap this whole little run with a ballad remake of Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. So suddenly Neil Sedaka was bigger than he had ever been before. And to me, even though, like you said, I don't necessarily need to listen to this song every day, and Neil Sedaka himself is on record saying that his fans don't even request this song ever, despite the fact that it was number one, I still think that this is a great example of what we're talking about. And it may not be my favorite song, but it is absolutely fits the brief. And so I also gave it 2 points. And the patrons did not, but we both did. So there you go.
All right.
Now, we don't have a clip of the next song, which is Believe by Cher. I don't know that at this early stage in the game, we need a clip of this song. My suspicion is if you listen to this show, you do know what that song sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Cher, spoiler, is going to show up again in a later episode of this season because Cher has come back so many times. But to my mind, Believe is just another great example of what a comeback is because she had not in America had even a top, she had not had a top 10 hit since 1990 with the song Just Like Jesse James. And then 9 years later, she reached number one for 4 weeks with Believe and then went on to be the number one song of 1999, like the whole year.
Yeah.
And Believe introduced auto-tune into popular music. Like the auto-tune effect of the garbly voice. So like this song is not only a comeback, it was the biggest hit of its year and it launched a new musical era. So I absolutely had no problem putting it through this first round. Sarah, how about you?
Same. I, as I said, did sort of rank mine in order and shuffle the list around a little bit, trying to work through my feelings and definitions on my side. This was at the top of my list. This was like the number one for this quadrant. Mm-hmm. Once it was there, never moved. I like the Wikipedia entry for this song calls it a complete musical departure, which like I'm not sure that's true, but it is like different enough from the last set of hits, which were themselves comebacks.
Yes.
Sometimes, like, even if it's not, you have a bunch of different axes. You have, like, how different is this to previous work? How far removed from it is previous work? And how thoroughly did it beast previous work? Can also be a metric.
Right.
And, like, that this was absolutely etched on the gold record of your DNA if you were sentient at this time when it was out.
Yes.
I mean, you could not get through a day without hearing it, and that was not a bad thing. I had some friends who spent enough time in gay bars that they were like, I love her, but I cannot. And they would just like go on the roof when this played. It was like,
Seriously, for a good 2 years, it was every time you went into a gay bar, this song was on.
It really, yeah. And, there's like porn on over the bar. People are just playing cards and just like people kept putting it on the, in Barracuda, I think they had to take it out of the jukebox because the bartenders were like, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to claw my own ear out. I can't do it anyway. But
there was a gay bar in Atlanta. There was a gay bar in Atlanta called Backstreet. I mean, it may still be there. Where a screen would come down and this music video would be projected on it.
Oh, yeah. You told me about that.
I think it was, if you go back in our archives, listeners, there is an episode where we rank all of Cher's top 10 hits.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually episode 200. Mm-hmm. But that, I think I may have told that story then, but oh my God, like that just, that was the song where like the screen comes down and we just all give our attention to it. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So you and I both waved it through. What did the listeners decide?
Oh, they did as well. It's okay. A straight six for so Believe.
Our first six. Fantastic.
Now, next, I'm very curious to know what you think about this next song. Speaking of gay anthems, this is Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head. But before we talk about it, let's listen to a clip.
I don't think I realized this song was as old as it is.
Yeah, like 2001?
Yeah.
Pretty old at this point, which is weird to think about.
I mean, a lot of turn of the millennium shit that we're talking about in this first episode of the Do Call It a Comeback season. I didn't really get the sense that Kylie had ever gone anywhere, at least in the cohort that I was spending time with at this time. So I didn't really feel like this was a comeback so much. And like, I love her existence while not necessarily being able to pick her songs out of a lineup. Mm-hmm. So I voted no on this, and it wasn't especially close because I didn't really feel like this was a comeback for her. But if you want to drop some chart on us, I would love it.
All right. Well, so in the United States, Kylie Minogue had not charted at all since 1988. That's zero presences on the Hot 100 until this song in 2001 returned her to the top 10 for only the second time after her remake of The Locomotion, where it peaked at number 7. And to me, that was, I remember so clearly at the time, shocking. That Kylie Minogue got to come back. And it's interesting that we were running in different cohorts, clearly, because in Europe, especially in the UK, Kylie Minogue had really never gone anywhere. She'd had ups and downs where her songs would peak at number 9 instead of number 1, but she was just always kind of there.
Right. I think I was spending more time with like Brit pop people who, while they weren't necessarily listening to or caring about Kylie Minogue, she was like, oxygen, basically. So she was there.
If you do not live in England, especially, it can be hard to grasp how popular Kylie Minogue is, was, and will always be. She is at a level of fame in England that rivals Madonna. And she's had so many hits. She's so famous that her sister, Dani Minogue, has had pop hits basically because of the last name, mm-hmm. not because the songs are all that good. People just adore Kylie. But in America, I feel that she is a true comeback success story, at least with this song. She's going to actually also be in this countdown again, or this season again later, with a song that just came out this year. But we'll get to that. So for me, this was a top song, as it was for the listeners. So that's 4 points. I do also want to add a little bonus fun chart fact. This song was also a comeback of sorts for its co-writer, Kathy Dennis, who you might remember if you've been listening long enough, wrote favorite song from the 7th grade, Touch Me All Night Long. So Kathy Dennis.
BH prom song. Never forget.
That's exactly right. Thank you, Beverly Hills 90210 soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
But Kathy Dennis wrote this, and then a few years later, she wrote Toxic by Britney Spears. So the early aughts were very good to Kathy Dennis as a mm-hmm. songwriter of globally dominant dance pop hits. But yeah, so there we are. So I'll be interested to see if Can't Get You Out of My Head makes it into our next round. But I am, for me, happy to give it the 2 points. And like I said, the listeners did as well. Now, we do have a clip for our next song, which is Cold Heart by Elton John and Dua Lipa, but the comeback in question is for Elton John. Obviously, Dua Lipa is in the first blush of her success.
Mm-hmm.
She's in her opening run of hits. She has one right now from the Barbie soundtrack. But Elton John, when Cold Heart was released, had not been in the top 10 since 1998. And then almost 25 years later, this song is still, again, very current. It reached number 7 in America. So that is a really, really long gap between hits. But does it count for our purposes here as a major comeback? Well, let's listen to a clip and then decide. Cold Heart. Now, Sarah, I will say this. In my annual creation of best of the year playlists, Cold Heart did, in fact, make it in for 2022 as one of my favorite songs of the year. I love this song. I find it very pleasing. I kind of never get tired of it. But for me, it is not going through to the next round for a couple of reasons. One, Elton John is so dominant as a figure in popular culture that he doesn't need hits to be omnipresent. Agreed. So I feel like it's all, even though he had come back to the top 10, he had never, ever gone away.
No.
You're just always aware of Elton John. And to really count as a truly classic comeback hit, I don't think you can just have pieces of your old hits stitched together into a new hit. And this song, Cold Heart, is just pieces of earlier Elton John songs mashed together. This is the Elton John part comes from the song Sacrifice. Obviously, Dua Lipa is singing part of Rocket Man. And then there are other lesser known songs sprinkled in there as well. So to me, though I am glad that he had another top 10 hit with this song, though I do like it, it is not going through to the next round.
I agree. I did not put it through. It was sort of like at the towards the top of the bottom half, but still in the bottom half. I give this song enormous credit for like using snippets of songs that only I like and a snippet of a song that I never liked and turning it into a song that I did like. I've never really cared for Sacrifice. I've always thought it was a little bit glurgy, as you said about something else earlier.
A little saccharine, if you will.
Yes. Bathetic, perhaps.
Ooh, yes.
With a B, and the B stands for bitch. But I like the idea of this, and I really like that these two are like doing something together, and that this was part of a like Elton John being like shut in basically with a pandemic toddler or whatever. It was just like, I need to find something to do. Like, okay, well, do something with Dua Lipa. Smart. Good call. I like the idea of this, but your point that Elton John has really never gone away and that we were really just at this time, like still in kind of the, not undertow, but like, you know, there was a whole movie about him. It got awards attention. Like, I just don't think you can necessarily call this a comeback, especially since he's paired with someone who is so current right now. So that's my feeling was ixnay. What did the listeners do?
Well, they agree with us. It's goose eggs across the board for Cold Heart. But
I feel like those two crazy kids are going to be okay.
I do, too. I think they've got a future in this business called show. Now, next up, we have got the song Come Dancing, which was a number 6 hit in 1982 for the Kinks. They had not been in the top 10 in America since 1970. With Lola, a song that featured in our most recent season, First Name Basis. So, you know, hey, Ray Davies, back again. Before we listen to the clip, Sarah, I'm curious to know, did you have a prior relationship with this song?
I absolutely did. It's been on my hashtag old lady walk list for years. I loved this from the moment I first saw the video on MTV. And this is, I think, the first of our sort of subgenre, which is 60s bands trying to Reagan it up in the 80s. The way that the king, like often the band in question gets kind of ground up in the gears of a new sound or like trying to do two things at once for old fans and, you know, youngins watching MTV. Brothers Davies are too smart for that. I feel this was like a good video that like kind of took itself out of the Heritage Act conversation by telling a story that was even further in the past than the band itself and their history is. And that brass at the end is just, this is like, once again, from the Kinks, absolute tonal mastery of their narrative, which is like a thin enough slice to be unusual and compelling, but not so thin that it's like these lyrics could be talking about anything. Like their specificity of narrative in their lyrics is amazing. And it's a fun song, I think. But you said you never really heard it before. You didn't remember ever hearing it before we started prepping this. Is it true?
That is correct. I had no prior relationship with this song, but I love it. I mean, it turns out Ray Davies can write a song. I don't know if you are aware.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And, you know, also to bring British Music Hall, which is like their answer to vaudeville, into the top 10 in the 80s. What? What? I say with an extremely aspirated WH.
Yeah.
I wanted to read a comment that our listener Karen V wrote on our Patreon page where she said, I wanted to give Come Dancing all 7 of my votes because we asked them to vote for 7 songs in this group. It's a delightful song that has a sweet story about the Davies themselves, a throwback style hit in the middle of the 1980s Brit invasion, and just deserves a master's thought or two. And I think that that's right on. And for those of you who don't know the story, which I did not until I started to prep this episode, this song is an homage to Ray Davies' sister, who used to love to go out dancing in dance hall clubs, and she died on the dance floor. She was very young, and she had a heart attack while dancing and died. This song is in no way maudlin. It is a celebration of her, but it is very wistful because if you listen to the lyrics, it's about how the club has disappeared. Mm-hmm. But if you know the story, that's also a nice metaphor for how she, too, has disappeared from his life, but not from his memory. And that just gives the song this extra bit of complexity that I respect even more. And so I'm really, really glad to have heard it and to be thinking about it. And I'm glad that this year on Mastis has really been the year of the Kinks because I needed to know more about them than I did.
Yeah. Let's hear a clip.
Yes.
Supermarket used to stand. Before that, they put up a bowling alley on the site that used to be the local pally. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday. Come dancing. All her boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural.
And that ba-da-da-da-da, like the with the chime sound, it's like it's so good. And there's something about his delivery of, and when they said come dancing, my sister always did. That's like this fond, but also sort of exasperated memory because he would always be kept up by like she'd come in late and she and her mom are fighting. And basically this could have been from the perspective of my brother if I hadn't been out, you know, quote, dancing. Whatever. I was out fucking smoking cigarettes, not in that order. Anyway,
finally be told.
Yes. people are like, what? This is the first Kinks song I think I ever knew I was hearing. Like that I knew that it was the Kinks versus like in the background on like FM radio. And it's still my favorite. Sorry, Cool Kids. And I did think that this was a legit comeback, even though having just been thinking about Lola so closely earlier this year, I don't think it's a huge departure in terms of their artistry, but it was a while and it was different enough. And so, yeah, it is going through for me. What about you?
Oh, God, this was such a hard... This, like... The 8th slot for me was a killer in this group.
Mine too.
There are 3 songs that were all vying for 8th place. And at the end of the day, although I really like this song, the fact that I had never heard it until the last like 3 weeks is what made me decide I'm not going to give it points, but oh my God, I like it so much. So for me, it was no. And for the listeners, it was no.
Oh,
but
no.
But I fully respect and got so close to agreeing with your 2 points. So, but
Karen,
choices have to be made.
Girl, I tried.
Yeah.
And I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll be enough. Maybe we got a bunch of goose eggs happening here. And I don't know. We'll find out.
If it were Mark, Sarah, and Karen talk about songs, I think it would have gotten through in a breeze.
Mac does.
Okay. Now, next, Sarah, you may have noticed that I slacked you earlier this week to say I might need 2 hours to talk about the song The Crying Game.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get into that, let's listen to a clip. Sarah, I'll let you start. Tell me your thoughts, feelings, and dreams around this song.
I'd just like to share first that I know this is a notoriously visual medium of podcasting, but we are on Zoom together, and Mark is like staring into the middle distance with his hand on his chin, like transported somewhere. We are about to find out where. But first, a few brief remarks. From Buncey. There is something about this song, like every time I hear it, I am struck by two things. First of all, that in the 30 odd years since it came out, holy shit, all of the meta cultural things that should like have obscured it or weighed it down. In fact, it, in my opinion, buoy it and make it more. Including all of the sort of like flippant Ace Ventura garbage-y jokes about the film, The Crying Game, and the big reveal therein that we all kind of had to endure for the remainder of the 90s. The other thing that strikes me always is that this vocal is not great, but that works too, because you're used to Boy George's that just sort of extremely rich, elastic tone and timbre that he had in the 80s, which for a variety of reasons, it, possibly for artistic reasons or as the result of active choices, it's not present here. I suspect it's possibly not taking very good care of the instrument in the intervening years, but there's something about this being a comeback song for this person in this venue, and that the instrument is diminished, but that puts a spotlight on the artistry and sort of that the comebackiness is so crucial to this song's like personhood. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm really getting into some like high teleological weeds over here, but my point is that there is a lack of power that the song has that then like doubles its power, and that this vocal is kind of just a B plus from Boy George means that emotionally it's an A plus, at least for me. This is a lot of talking to say that it absolutely was going through for me, and to think about all the different things that comeback can mean, especially for a troubled soul and troubled artist soul who maybe isn't able to use his instrument the way he used to be, but finds a way to make that powerful and effective, was cool. And it's the whole fucking point of doing this podcast. But also the point of doing this podcast is to hear you talk. So why don't you do that?
Well, you know, this, the way that you just described this record makes me think about the Johnny Cash cover of Hurt by Nine Inch Nails.
Yes.
Where the song itself transcends, the performance transcends the song to also tell us a story about the performer. And that is so powerful because it reminds us how much we know culturally about a performer, even if we haven't thought about them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to be right at the time, it was so easy to make the jokes like, of course, Boy George is singing The Crying Game for a movie about gender fluidity and like all of the stuff that you just alluded to. But really, yes, this is a song full of sort of outre suffering.
Yeah,
there's just yes. It's perfumed with queer emotion in a way that is so exactly right for Boy George, because he had been through very public struggles with drugs. By this point, he had been quite public about the collapse of his sexual relationship with John Moss in the Culture Club. Culture Club had a big old flop of a third album and then kind of vanished from the scene. It had been almost a decade, really, since they had a huge hit. So for Boy George to come back, like you said, at a B-plus vocal, but with that beaten and bruised but still here energy, is just so
and
right. It's so...
Not for nothing, some of the all-time great eye makeup in a video.
Oh, my God. And the video is, if you look... One of the things
it's Madonna's Rain video, but he like, good steal. Good call.
When I was watching this video again, I realized this video looks like it cost about $45.
Oh my God, it's so budge. Except the makeup is flawless.
Chef and says. You get the feeling that Boy George did the makeup himself at home.
Oh yeah.
Because he was like, I don't trust you motherfuckers to handle all this. But he looks so perfectly right as himself. And the other thing that's, I think, so interesting about this is The Crying Game had been a number five hit in the UK in 1965 for an artist named Dave Berry. And then Brenda Lee recorded it. Many other people recorded it. But I don't think any of them unlocked the pathos the way that Boy George did. And this also has something to do with the fact that the production on this song is by the Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, God, yes.
They just are so good at perfuming things with outre gay emotion.
Yeah.
It's just like...
But there's also a little bit of... It's like when Padma's like, the dish needs acid. The Pet Shop Boys know how to get a little bit of tang in there so that you don't get the diabetes.
Well, and that's exactly right. This song is... It's filled with pathos, but it is not maudlin.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad, but it isn't whiny. Because there is that edge of the production, the sort of rolling synth sound in it. I find that the Pet Shop Boys are so good at elevating queer icons into something else that feels almost bigger than them when they give them their production. The Pet Shop Boys did a fantastic song with Liza Minnelli, her cover of Sondheim's Losing My Mind, but they made it into a dance song. If you have not heard it, run now to the internet and find Liza Minnelli's Losing My Mind. It is a masterpiece. And the Pet Shop Boys will be back later this season with another time that they did this exact thing for someone else.
God. So good.
I have no... even when I was 13 years old in the summer of 91, when this song was popular, I was defenseless before it, but it has actually only grown in its impact. Its impact on me has only grown in the intervening years. I feel like the older I get, the more I appreciate all of the shit that this song is doing.
Mm-hmm.
It is so funny to me that it was written by a guy named Jeff Stevens, who wrote There's a Kind of Hush All Over the World by Herman's Hermits and Daddy, Don't You Walk Away So Fast by Wayne Newton. Like, what? Okay. But the Pet Shop Boys, they found something deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question that this song is going through for me. In fact, I just am powerless before it. It just something about it moves me so much. And like, this song peaked at number 15 on the Hot 100. It didn't even make the top 10. And yet, it absolutely forced us to acknowledge Boy George as a lasting talent. And it's also worth noting that the movie The Crying Game was originally called The Soldier's Wife, and then they renamed it The Crying Game because this song was being used so prominently. So it's like, it's just part of the culture forever. And I think that if this song had not been a hit, we might think slightly less of the Culture Club's legacy. But Boy George having this song come out later, I think actually buoyed the Culture Club in our memories too. Anyway, an easy yes for me.
What about the listeners?
They also agreed. So this is our second six of the day.
All right.
There we go. Hey, Boy George, get your business.
Get a giant fedora. Fill it with drinks and let's celebrate. Okay, what's...
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Next
is Robin's Dancing on My Own. Oh, God. Woo! It's one of my favorite songs of all time, frankly. So guess what? I'm just going to jump the gun and tell you, of course, yes, I said yes to this. Robin had two big pop hits in 1997 in the United States. They were also among the first hits for Max Martin, who has gone on to be like Max Martin. Now, she did have albums that came out in Sweden but didn't go anywhere in the rest of the world. And then she had an album that was simply called Robin that was popular in an underground way in the early 2000s, even in the United States. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I was absolutely listening to that album. It had songs on it like With Every Heartbeat and Be Mine. But Dancing on My Own changed the trajectory of Robin's career forever, because it is now one of those songs that every website who does the best songs of the 2000s will include Dancing on My Own. This was absolutely the pinnacle of crying at the club music that so many artists have been making ever since. Dancing on My Own was remade by a man named Callum Scott, and his version actually reached the Hot 100. Now, Robin's version did not, but it does, you don't have to chart to have a huge impact. So I feel that Dancing on My Own absolutely deserves to move through. It is a great example of not only a comeback hit, but a comeback hit that redefines our understanding of who an artist is.
I just don't care about Robin one way or the other.
As we've learned in previous episodes of this very show.
Oh, yes. Episode 30 that I was like, why don't you just tell me the name of the thing I'm supposed to... Anyway.
I'd love to hear what you like about this song.
I know. Let me interview you about this, about JVC Robin. It's like, it's not a bad song, obviously. I am happy for her. Listening to it again, I was like, is this the one that we covered for episode 30? And I looked and I didn't write down which song we actually covered.
It was
covered.
Call Your Girlfriend.
Yes,
it was Call Your Girlfriend that we covered.
Which I think I actually was a little more intrigued by than this one. And possibly it's because I've heard this a bunch of times, or it was used a bunch of times for, like flashbacks to heartbreak at the club on TV shows. I'm not sure what it is. I did notice this time around listening to it that there's this like retro Human League thing happening in it that I think is like intellectually interesting, even though aurally I'm kind of still feeling a little sleepy. But yeah, this is not going through for me because I couldn't really like hook into which comeback axis this was on, and if it goes through without me, I respect that and I will try to think about it some more, but that's a no for me. Dogs, what'd the listeners do?
I mean, look, I'm not surprised, and I respect that. And I'm sure that you're not surprised that I'm over here being like, well, I built three temples out of bronze, marble, and glass to this song that can be found at the following locations. Put it into Google Maps. But the listeners also did put it through for this round. Although I have to say, having already thought about the songs in next week's episode, which will then, you know, be part of the next round as well, I don't know if I'm going to move this song further if it goes ahead. I don't know if it's going to go from my top, you know, if it is going to go beyond round two for me. I don't know, but we'll find out. Yep. But I did feel strongly about it here. Next.
Oh, God.
I cannot believe how many thoughts I have about the Doobie Brothers' number nine peaking hit, The Doctor, which was their first top 20 hit in 9 years when it reached number nine in the mid-80s. The lead vocal is by Tom Johnston, who had left because of health problems.
And came back and left.
And then was replaced by Michael McDonald and left again. And Sarah, I don't know about you, but my eyes glaze over when I hear about these 70s bands and their constantly shifting lineups.
What a bunch of fucking eighth grade girls. Like, fuck, just go in the parking lot and slap it out. Fuck.
Yeah. It's just like
Michael McDonald was mean to me. Michael McDonald saying back up and he's diluting the brand. Mom, like, oh my God, nobody fucking cares.
Mom, he didn't even respect the fact that I wrote Jesus is Just All Right. Oh, shut up.
Why don't you China Grove fuck yourself?
I mean, as I've said on so many occasions on this show, your erection is not magical.
No.
And your erection as manifested by your jockeying for position inside your middle of the road rock band is not that magical either. Just shut the fuck up.
Oh my God. Ah!
Now, because I suspected that we would not have a chance to talk about it
again.
God,
I hope you're right.
I just thought, okay, let's just play a clip of The Doctor. Here's The Doctor.
I wish I had taken some screenshots because, like, we were both just overcome by the nope of it all. Oh, God.
I was happy to have been educated about the existence of Come Dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I also had no memory whatsoever of The Doctor and now can never return to that blessed time.
I know. Yeah. The doctor is out. Like, once you hear a lyric that contains the phrase Frisco Bay, you know what you're in for, which is like heritage, mid-sized stadium, summer tour, whole lot of fucking Hawaiian shirts and straw hats. And this is basically China Grove. They just repackaged it for the 80s. Like, this is a 60s turn of the 70s. Frisco Bay barf band that had all the, you know, eighth grade back of the bus drama that we were just talking about and Michael McDonald and but like the Doobies, ugh, and I hate it when people call them the Doobies. It like makes me want to kick something. But the version of the band that I listened to was the pre-Michael McDonald shit that my parents were into, that we listened to on car trips whenever the Doobies cassette came up in the row. My brother and I were both like, my brother's like, please, can I come on your side and have one half of your headphones? Or just like, can you scream at me for 44 minutes for being on your side of the bag so that we don't have to listen to this nonsense? And I was always like, I enjoy screaming at you, younger sibling. Let's do this. This is bad. With that said, it was close to my putting it through because I think that this... there is, like I said, that subset of these comeback songs that are like, yep, 60s and 70s bands seeing that they can try to pick up with a new generation on MTV. So it's like, let's have one of those videos where we're all having a rollicking good time and like laughing in each other's direction during a live show. And then there's like a dog in the audience and you're like, I don't.
And that dog has a bandana and sunglasses.
Yeah. And you're just like, oh my God. Like if you try any harder, you're going to get a second hernia on top of the one that meant you had to quit the tour in 77. Tom. Anyway, it's a no for me. What did the listeners do? Because I can't imagine you voted for this shit.
The listeners also graciously passed on the opportunity to continue to think or talk
about
this.
We're all uninsured for this particular doctor. Great.
But I feel like I just need to say, you talking about this being at an outdoor summer jam is exactly right. Every single time I have listened to this song, I have imagined an audience at an outdoor venue, none of whom are facing the stage because they're all holding plastic cups of beer talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of song that's playing in the background and you're kind of like holding your cup and you're sort of like lightly bopping back and forth, but you're talking to someone about whether or not the burgers are done on the little tiny grill that you brought with you to the venue.
Right.
And, you know, and like, fine, there is absolutely a place in the world for a song like that. And if I were currently at an outdoor park and I was eating a hot dog and this song were playing, I would be like, this is fine. But here's, and like, look, that, and that's fine. But here's what isn't fun. The Successories poster lyrics about music being the doctor of your soul are so stupid. It's so dumb. It's like this is the kind of Successories poster where a kitten is in a white lab coat with a little stethoscope and the kitten is somehow also standing on a piano, and then it says, music is the doctor of my soul. It's just so...
And there's also a sailboat somehow. Like, yes. What are we...
And it's sunset, and there's an eagle driving the sailboat. Like, it's just so absolutely banal and asinine. And I just feel like... And Sarah, it takes a lot for this to be true, but when you are less sophisticated than Huey Lewis and the News in terms of making lyrical statements at this period of the 80s, you really need to look at your life and look at your choices, because The Power of Love or The Heart of Rock and Roll, actually even better comparison, The Heart of Rock and Roll is actually a more sophisticated lyric about what music does to the soul than this.
Yeah.
And that is not a position that one wants to find oneself in. So it's a straight zero for the Doobies. And between this and the fucking What a Fool Believes from the Record of the Year season, I've just had it with the Doobie Brothers, Sarah. I've had it.
Yeah. And also, Michael McDonald absolutely was just like jizzing all over the Grammy season. It's like, is that Michael McDonald doing the background vocal on Harry Mancini's, like, why?
Yeah,
he's playing
sure
the mandolin
was.
Right now. Like, get that Michael McDonald out of here. I gave it
oh
the
my
office.
God. Sweet freedom. Okay.
I actually love that song. I know it's really wrong.
I know. I do too. It's listen, I had no kick with that song. Michael McDonald is a complete cheese ball whom I respect. That's what I will say.
I mean, I like cheese. Just the. Yeah.
Actually, if someone were to hand me a cheese ball right now with the little almond slivers in it, I would eat it. So it's fine.
Oh my God. Someone should do, you know, like molded butter pats. Someone should do molded cheese pats of like yacht rock stars.
Yes. Oh my God. You could make a fortune.
Mm-hmm. Sold. Here I am just giving paste. The idea away.
Okay. Well, next up is the number two hit from 1989, Don't Know Much by Linda Ronstadt, featuring the comeback artist in question, Aaron Neville. Aaron Neville had not had a hit since Tell It Like It Is in 1966, so 23 years prior. Don't Know Much was originally recorded in 1980 by co-writer Barry Mann, who wrote it with Cynthia Weil and Tom Snow, but it didn't really break until this album. This single was co-produced by Peter Asher, who had also just the year prior produced the In My Tribe album by the 10,000 Maniacs. So Peter Asher was doing it all for everyone.
Uh-huh.
this is one of the songs in this week's countdown, along with The Crying Game, that ends with a male artist going, ah, which I just enjoy. Sarah, here's the thing. I did not put this song through. I'm just going to say that, but this was so close. This is one of the songs where I was in a constant fight for eighth place, and I think I love this song. I still love it. I've always loved it. I want to intellectually resist it, but there's just something about it that I can't. I think their voices are so lovely. It really did resurrect Aaron Neville's career. He had a top 10 hit that Linda Ronstadt co-produced in the early 90s with Everybody Plays the Fool.
Oh, which is an all-timer. So good.
That's a chef's kiss. And he wouldn't have had that if this song hadn't happened. So props to Linda Ronstadt for really, for several years, working on behalf of Aaron Neville. They had another hit from this album called All My Life, which is cheesy but good. Like, I have a real soft spot for this song, and as I'm talking about it, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Why didn't I put this through? But I didn't. Okay, there it is.
What did the listeners do?
They did. They gave it 2 points.
All right. I also put it through because this is a legit, like, there had been a long time between his hits. This is, I mean, in terms of a comeback, like, sometimes you're looking at like a slight change or tweak that finally lets this artist really like break through, or break through in a different way or for a different reason. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is sort of true here, that a duet with Linda Ronstadt might have read as like a little bit cheesy and extra to a lot of people, but was the perfect vessel for this song and for his voice and for his career to sort of be brought back. But what really was interesting to me when I was listening to this song, which I like, not as well as Everybody Plays the Fool, but I like this song. It's a nice vocal from both of them. I think they're matched up well. But I just couldn't stop thinking about, like, why was this necessary? Like, this voice is extremely, like, it's unique in pop. It's extremely elastic, and sometimes it can be grating when he's like not controlling it. But in the initial huge hit that he had back in the 60s, it was very controlled. And I mean, you know, it was very emotional, but it was controlled compared to like the, you know, Touch the Feel of Cotton commercials, where he's just all over, like, just glissandoing himself into
the fabric of our lives.
Migraine. It was crazy. But yeah, I just was thinking, like, where had he been? Like, what was, I mean, he was doing stuff, and he was, you know, doing gospel and Neville Brothers and other stuff. Like, it's not like he was, you know, working in a pencil factory or something. But it's like, huh, I just was wondering about that, and why it doesn't happen for certain distinctive vocalists like this guy. So, but yeah, I put it through.
And listen, I think that's, I was just so torn. I'm glad that it has 4 points. That means it has a fighting shot to get through to next week and or next time. And I agree with you. It's just so interesting to think that Aaron Neville needed to come back when many people who are not as skilled as he is never left. But there you go. Yeah. Now, the next one, I was at first, you actually suggested that we talk about The Flame by Cheap Trick. And I was like, no, Cheap Trick, the Flame, like that's not a comeback. They just, Cheap Trick is a huge band. It turns out, nope, I have a false memory of Cheap Trick having more hits than they actually had, because they had not had a top 10 when The Flame reached number one in 1988, since 1977 with I Want You to Want Me, and their albums had bricked. They were just like out of luck, S-O-L. Yeah. And then suddenly with The Flame, a song that they did not write, which I understand the band was frustrated about, they got to number one, and they were right up there at the top of the power ballad Olympics of the late 80s. And the reason I think that I misremembered their popularity is because of the enormity of this song in my imagination. To me, The Flame is one of those definitive power ballads. It's like one of the best, I think. It's so over the top. The lyrics don't even make sense, because there's like he's like, I'm talking about, I am the fire, but then I will also be the flame. Like, you're the fire in two ways. Great. Then it doesn't matter. Just sing, hit me with it. Great. So for me, this is the song that was in that three-way battle for eighth place, and it made it. This is the one I ultimately chose for me to go through because I just think it is such a great song that basically blows away any idea that the band had ever left to me. And that is the sign of a good comeback.
This is one of the first songs that I thought of to be on this list because I was a junior in high school when it came out. But at that time, I was a radio listener. And I listened to K-Rock, which was classic rock, and like PLJ and Z100 and 102.7, which now I think is club stuff, but back then was new rock with Scotso in the afternoon telling you what you should be looking out for and listening to. And that's how I learned about REM, was listening to that guy.
Oh,
but
hey.
It was really an interesting experience in the late 80s because you would hear Cheap Trick, like Surrender and like the old mid 70s hits and Budokan era stuff on like CBS FM oldies sometimes, but then definitely on classic rock. And then you would flip to PLJ, which was like top 40, and you would hear The Flame, and you heard The Flame multiple times a day, whether you wanted to or not. I had not heard it in 30 years. I was totally fine with that. But listening to it again, I was like, oh, damn, this is absolutely, you could teach this in schools as how to construct a power ballad, not least because everyone involved looks in the video and sounds in the track like they don't really want to be there. But they're still, they're like, well, this is how it's done, so let's just gut it out. Like, all the pieces, like the construction of the song basically just pulls everyone along and it's bigger than they are. And they just have this like big frizzy sort of randomly metal hair. Nobody looks like they're totally into this whole rebrand, but a rebrand it absolutely was. And this song and Cheap Trick were both omnipresent for a year and a half as a result. This was a huge comeback, even though they were pretty big before as like a mid-70s arena rock band. But they, like, if you look at their Wikipedia entry, it's like one section is, you know, the 70s and Budokan. And then the next section is like wandering in the wilderness without a compass. And you're like, the 80s. And you're like, oh, Jesus. And then the next section is The Flame, which saved them all from basically being unhoused, I think. So,
yeah,
this was a no-brainer for me. Number two on my list for this section overall. And so that's 2 points for me, too.
And yet the listeners chose not to put it through. So here we are with a 4 point
total
for The Flame.
All right.
You're so right. It's really like the 70s, live at Budokan popularity. Then the next section, no one gives a rat's damn about you. You may as well be dead. I wish you would eat wet cigarette butts.
Even cheaper trick.
Exactly. Okay, now next up, and one of the things that's, I think, going to be a theme of this entire first section of the season is that I will be the one who is writing for the songs that are super current, because we've had quite a few comments from the patrons so far that they're like, I don't even know what this song is, these songs that came out in the last like 4 or 5 years, but I wanted them in the mix, even if they go no further. That is why we are about to hear a clip from Miley Cyrus's 2023 hit Flowers. It was number one for 8 weeks. It's currently still on the charts. Here is a clip of Flowers. I can take myself dancing. Her pronunciations are so weird. Look, she's
I love her.
She's a little bit affected.
Even when did we talk about the When I See You Again? We talked about ages ago.
God, like 1981, I think we talked about that.
I mean, just as a person, I feel like Miley Cyrus is like that cousin who's like really annoying and stands a little too close to you, but also is like so well-meaning and sometimes hilarious. And if you had to bury a body, you could absolutely call her, even though you look around sometimes and she's just like absentmindedly eating paint. You're like, okay. I mean, I am fond of Miley and how she seems to have accepted that, like, she lives out loud in public and has no choice about it. So she's just going to, like, lean in to that.
Right.
I respect it. She does some weird fashion shit that I'm like, is that your nipple? Did you move it to your armpit? All right. Let us know. Keep us posted. Take care. This song, I am a little shocked. Like, if I've heard of it, I've heard it. So it's everywhere. Because I'm an old lady who, like, listens to instrumentals for fun. But I didn't pass it through because, I mean, I'm sure that there are, and I looked, there are chart facts that make this, you know, that sort of, like, give this accreditation as a comeback hit. And this is by far her biggest charting hit, right? It's, like, light years ahead of anything else that she did, but because I am a, you know, cultural critic and I live in the world, I personally don't feel like she ever went anywhere in terms of, like, being in the conversation. Like, I feel like I see headlines about her, even though I'm not looking for them. I know that's not necessarily a criterion, but, and I, you know, I'm thrilled for her and this is great. Quantum Leap Forward, good for you, but I didn't pass it through. It was close, but I was like, there's just something about this that feels like this is bigger than she's done, but it's not a comeback. It's an evolution, and in my head, that timeline doesn't quite qualify it. But if it gets through, I got no kick with it. It's a fine song. I don't need to own it, but it's great.
I think that we're very much aligned here, because from a chart perspective, this is her biggest hit ever. Mm-hmm. And her previous number one single was Wrecking Ball, which is like 10 years old, which I also cannot believe.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. That's fucking insane. Jesus. How
has it been a decade?
I still think of her as still being like not old enough to drink in a bar. But that's not, she's like in her 30s now, right? Like,
yes, I know. Lost it. And it's like, and Wrecking Ball is a decade old. Now, in the intervening years, she has had a couple of minor chart hits that did reach the top 10, but she hasn't had anything like this since Wrecking Ball. But I agree with you that she's never gone away. And hit singles are just one of the many ingredients in the overall Miley Cyrus recipe. And it's like, sometimes she has hits, sometimes she makes news. It's like, Miley Cyrus is just a pop culture presence that is, mm-hmm. she's bigger than hits at this point, you know, like, or she doesn't only need hits to be a presence. So though this is absolutely her biggest hit and in many ways a huge return to form for her on the pop charts, you're right. Like, you have to go away before you can come back. And Miley Cyrus has never done that since the day that Hannah Montana put on that wig. She has never left us. So did not get through for me, nor did it get through for the listeners. So that's nothing for Flowers, but I'm glad it's in the conversation because, you know, it's helpful to think about these things, especially as we consider like artists who never leave us, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Now, Sarah, you are on record in previous episodes of this show having limited enthusiasm for the 80s era Aretha Franklin catalog.
Mm.
And I'll be interested to hear your thoughts about Freeway of Love, which absolutely brought her back to the charts in a big way in 85. It reached number 3 in 85, and it was her first top 10 hit since Until You Come Back to Me in 1973. So Aretha had not had a really big pop hit in 12 years when Freeway of Love kicked off this run that also included, in my mind, the masterpiece Who's Zoomin' Who, as well as I Knew You Were Waiting for Me with George Michael, as well as Sisters Are Doing It for Themselves with the Eurythmics. But before we get into the comeback that this song hath wrought, let's listen to a clip of Freeway of Love.
Go!
no need to slow down for my exit. I'll just tuck and roll right out of this shit. I do find the song and this whole era of Aretha aurally unpleasant. I just don't care for it. There are like analogous sort of similar songs by from the same time by, say, the Pointer Sisters that are like not identical, but like functionally the same that I like fine. I don't know what it is about shouty performative party Ms. Franklin that I just don't, I don't vibe with it, and this is peak that. However, there is no denying the comebackitude of this track, and that whole generation. I mean, here we are again with that 60s, 80s split, like strictly speaking, it's 70s, but like, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
That her, you know, this is not really soul, but this is how a whole generation, like this is how Gen X learned who she was. And then, like, you know, you heard her in Carpool on the oldie station, but then you really understood that this was a sort of titan of popular music, because she still had hits and she was on MTV,
right,
doing the thing. This is one of the first songs you would think of if you, or like that a civilian in the street, if you were like, name five comeback songs, this would be on the list for most people in or around our age cohort. So I don't like the song, but it is a comeback for sure. And I gave it 2 points accordingly.
And I also just think it's worth noting that Natalie Cole also had a song about a pink Cadillac that was popular around this time.
Which I vastly preferred, even though it is objectively bad and worse than this.
Yes.
But I loved it. Loved it.
But I just think it's interesting that Bruce Springsteen originally didn't want a woman to record his song Pink Cadillac, the one that Natalie Cole wrote, because it's like about a woman's private parts.
Right.
But I just think it's pretty interesting that we have a pair of soul singers who decided that they would both sing about their pink Cadillacs and just let us decide what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
Funny moment of chart history. Natalie Cole will show up later in this season for a different song, so we'll get back to that.
Great.
I don't necessarily love this song. I think this song is perfectly fine. It's adequate. And I think it's just because I'm so familiar with it that I find it adequate. It's just... it's like not quite I Want to Dance with Somebody. It's not Jump for My Love, like you just said. It's just not as good as some of those other 80s R&B up-tempo jams, but it's fine. But like you said, there's no denying what it's what it achieved for Aretha Franklin's career. And I've read before about how much pressure there was on this album to bring her back to the fore, and it succeeded. So also for me, 2 points. Also 2 points from the listeners. This is a straight six for Freeway of Love.
Great.
So there you go. Now, I did not clip Madonna's Frozen. And Madonna's going to actually
Mark,
show up
we
twice.
Like never pay attention to Madonna on this podcast. Don't you think you want to rethink that?
Well, I just feel
decision?
Like who cares?
Who is Madonna? Yeah, really, whatever.
Madonna is not really someone who's had much of an impact on pop music or on us individually. We're definitely not going to see her in concert in December, having spent the GDP of a small country in order to get tickets. But that's definitely none of that's not happening. So I just didn't feel that we needed a clip of Frozen. No. But you know, this is another one where this kind of takes us back, Sarah, I think, to the American Idiot conversation, where in 1998, Frozen reached number 2 on the Hot 100, and it was a huge return to the center of the pop music conversation for Madonna, because in the preceding years, she had been in Evita. She'd had a hit from that, of course, with Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, and also You Must Love Me. In the years before that, she had released an album of ballad hits that featured You'll See, which was a hit as well. But she hadn't really been like, I felt like she had kind of felt like she was on the edge of the conversation, where when the Ray of Light album came out, she was right back in the center. So I feel like, and she also was someone who at this point was heralded for pushing electronic music into the center of the room. So suddenly mm-hmm. it was like the return of Madonna trendsetter as mm-hmm. well as pop music icon. So I do think that's why this song merits a discussion. But for me, because Madonna in the 90s especially was just always around, I'm not sure that she can count in this period of her career as a true comeback artist, even though Ray of Light is a watershed moment in a very impressive career. It's a peak even among the peaks.
Yeah, I really feel like this, you have to grade on different careers for different artists, yes. I would say. And I think that for Madonna, like for any other artist that we're talking about, or for some of the other artists, it's not pertinent, but like Madonna is sui generis for a lot of reasons. And I think in this particular conversation, like for another artist, for there to be like 18 months or 30 months between a top five or top 10 hit for that artist right. would be nothing. That would be an extremely right. solid career. And like, here's my sophomore effort and it sold pretty well. It went to like number nine, whatever. For Madonna, that's a right. lifetime, because there, this is each a different Madonna. Like every time another album comes out, you're like seeing another evolution. So it's actually sort of like not menudo, but you know what I mean? That it's like, it's right. just a kind of a different vid. And that this happened after, that Frozen was like after the Evita hits, which like they were hits, but they weren't really hits.
They weren't like blockbuster hits.
Right. And like, yeah. let's play these for the, novelty value is A, and B, that was one point, possibly one of the only points in her long career where she was trying to fit into something. Like right. into a pre-existing genre and into its dictates. And instead of being the tastemaker and the vanguard. Right. So I think that's a big part of why it didn't succeed, because, you know, she's not used to, like, she leads basically and right. doesn't. Right. With all of that said, like, because you have to grade her on that curve, I sort of like unfurled her discography on my monitor and was like, well, but is this for Madonna a comeback? I could not quite get there. There's like a whole bunch of songs that like once they slid under the eighth or ninth spot, it was like, well, I can't think about this anymore. That one was like right at like, it was like a number nine or something like that. And I was just like, I can't justify it, because Evita, I'm not sure she'd do that again, but it didn't do nothing. Like, she was in the conversation.
Right.
She got here and whatever.
She beat Frances McDormand for a Golden Globe.
Yeah. Like, she's not, I mean, she was in the conversation, and it wasn't like, I think people probably should have been meaner to Evita than they were, but she was like really trying to do something, and I think people respected that. So, all right, whatever. This didn't quite make it for me. As a comeback.
Yeah, and I agree, and nor did it make it for the listeners. So that's 0 points for Frozen, because wow. it's gonna take a lot more for an artist of Madonna's stature to generate the feeling that she's made a true comeback.
Yeah,
but she is coming back to this season in a few weeks, so we'll get back into that mm-hmm. later. And then our final song this week is "Get Lucky" by Daft Punk, featuring Nile Rodgers and Pharrell. This was absolutely a song that we discussed in our Record of the Year season,
sure,
although
was.
I've already forgotten everything we said about it, frankly. This song is a comeback for several reasons. One of our patrons, Jenna, noted that it's a comeback for Nile Rodgers, which is absolutely correct.
Yep.
And he had obviously been in Chic in the 70s, and then he produced a lot
fuck
of...
fuck off.
Yeah, that's right. And he had produced Like a Virgin for Madonna, among other things. But then it had been, this song came out in like 2013. So we're talking like decades and decades of time between Nile Rodgers having a major influence and having this big hit. And then it's also a comeback for Daft Punk, who had kind mm-hmm. of vanished from the scene after that late 90s, early aughts moment that they had. So this is a third comeback for pure disco. Like, mm-hmm. This is just such a disco song. There's no attempt to make it sound like anything else. This is a retro-sounding disco song. So on lots of levels, this song is a comeback, and I do think, I'm sure I said this at the time, but I'll say it again. Isn't it ironic that the record of the year never went to a disco song in the mm-hmm. 70s, but it did go to a disco song 30 years too late. But that being said, to me, this was absolutely in my top eight. So it did get 2 points from me, and it got 2 points from the listeners. We're up all night to the song. That's 4 points for this song. What do you think it's going to get?
Because I don't think it's a comeback. I mean, I do think it's a comeback, and everything that you've just given us in the factual was important intel. And this was close to the top half, but it just did not quite make it for me because I think that part of it is like, we've said this about previous seasons, like how much of the song's sustainability, I guess, or like continuing relevance as a topic comes from its status as what we're talking about. So
right.
Like the Moist FM season, do we still know this because of the song or because it's so moist or yachty or whatever you wanted to say about that season? Here, one of my metrics when I didn't quite know how to get my arms around a song otherwise was like, do we talk about this song because it's a comeback? Is right. it one of the first 5 or 10 examples of this? And for me, it wasn't quite there, and I couldn't quite justify it. But it does sound like it is moving ahead without me.
Well, except, okay, I've now looked at the final scores.
Is it a 4-fest?
Well, we have 3 songs that are 6s, and then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 songs that are 4s. We have to cut 2 in order to get down to our top 8. So our 3 6s are Believe, mm-hmm. The Crying Game, and Freeway of Love.
Okay.
So, okay. Now, our 4s are American Idiot, Bad Blood, Can't Get You Out of My Head, Dancing on My Own, Don't Know Much, The Flame, and Get Lucky.
All right. Are there any of these that only you and I voted for and listeners didn't? Because I feel like there weren't. That sometimes makes it easier.
Oh, no, there is. Only you and I voted for the Neil Sedaka song.
Okay. So let's boot Bad Blood. Sorry, buddy.
And only you and I voted for The Flame.
Oh.
Hard. But I will say, in kicking The Flame,
this result is lame. It's been stuck in my head for 2 days. This is what happens. Thanks a lot, guys. If that's the only other one that it was just you and me and the listeners didn't vote for it, and that kicking it out brings us down to 8,
one of the reasons I feel completely fine with that is because that means we do get to keep Don't Know Much, which I think in the process of talking about it on this episode, realized I actually think I should have chosen that anyway. Right. So I am fine with that.
Well, and how much else are we going to have to say about The Flame having hung a light on the Wikipedia entry that's like, and in 1981, a vast chasm opened and the entire band fell into it. I'm fine with that outcome, right?
All right. So then that means that, let me just recount this again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, okay. That means our top 8 from this round, moving forward to the next round, are American Idiot, Believe, Can't Get You Out of My Head, The Crying Game, Dancing on My Own, Don't Know Much, Freeway of Love, and Get Lucky.
Wow. Okay.
I feel fine with that.
I feel like almost nothing I voted for is here, but okay. Well,
let's see. American Idiot, you voted for, yeah. Believe.
I did vote for Believe. Crying Game.
The Crying Game, Don't Know Much, Freeway of Love. Those are yours that you selected.
Yeah, and I kind of wish Freeway of Love were not running right past my house for the next couple weeks, but it is what it is. Okay, an hour and 32 minutes later. Listeners,
oh, dear Lord,
thank you so much for your help. And if you are still here, please visit us at patreon.com/mastass to join the voting public for this. And also you get episodes early and without ads on them, if that is of interest. We would love to have you along. We also do happy hours and stuff. And it's a great group, as you have heard in the past. And next week, we are venturing further into the alphabet with artists such as One Republic, Stevie Wonder, Mr. Loaf, Ms. Warwick, and the Beach Boys, just for starters. So there's a lot going on, and I feel strongly about almost all of it, and so does Mark. So please join us, and thank you so much for listening today.
Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs is hosted by Mark Blankenship, that's me, and Sarah D. Bunting.
That's me. I also edit the podcast, which is a proud member of the Bleav Network. Learn more at bleav.com.
To learn more about us, submit song requests, get a pop chart reading, or buy a Mastass book, visit our website at markandsarahtalkaboutsongs.com. You'll also find all of our social media links there, too.
That's Mark and Sarah, with an H, talkaboutsongs.com. And for even more content and access to the Mastass Happy Hour, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/mastass.
Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.